Support for this public radio podcast comes from Thrivent Financial, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thriventfinancial.com/retirement.
Hi, I'm Lisa Napoli. Did the economic news this week leave you speechless? This guy feels your pain.
Down, Klein.
That's Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson with this week's Marketplace Money Inside quote. Paulson stammered out a brand new word to describe the troubles of a certain economic institution. Repeat after me.
Down, Klein.
So here's a quiz. What institution did Paulson say was downclining? Was it A, Bear Stearns? It lost most of its stock value this week. Or was it B, the dollar? It hit a record low against the euro on Monday. Or does downcline describe C, the whole U.S. economy? Here's a hint. The answer is C. And we've got advice for how to deal with it coming up on this week's Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money.
Lions and tigers and Bear Stearns. Oh, my. The financial giant succumbed to the credit crunch, and Wall Street got a bad case of the freakouts. Is there sense to be made of this mess? I'm Lisa Napoli in for Tess Vigeland, and this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
As you might imagine, this was one heck of a week to be working at a show that covers business and money. Even though in the end, stocks actually gained about 3% for the week, there were a lot of anxious moments. Everyone here at our sister program Marketplace was scrambling to tell the story.
Bear Stearns traders and dealers were told this morning that they are now J.P. Morgan employees, and their company stock, which had hit highs of $170 a share last summer, is now worth just $2 a share.
6 months, six rate cuts. That's where the Federal Reserve left us today.
The dollar is still under a lot of pressure. It's fallen this morning against both the yen and the euro.
With every action, there was a reaction. Everyone was waiting for the apocalypse. It didn't come, but there was quite a roller coaster ride.
Bernanke speaks, Wall Street listens, and thus we get the really happy music. The Dow Industrial shot up. The Dow slid 293 points today, 2.3% to close at 12,099. The Nasdaq. The Dow popped 261 points today, 2.1% to close at 12,361.
Thank God for Good Friday and a short trading week. Aside from the nervous market gazing, people were bandying about the R word. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson couldn't figure out what to call the mess.
We know we're in a sharp down climb, and there's no doubt that the American people know that the economy has turned down sharply.
You'd have to be living in a cave if you didn't, especially now. However you describe what's going on, everywhere this week there was debate over whether the 0.75 interest rate cut by the Fed was a good idea or large enough, and what the Bear Stearns implosion and subsequent government-subsidized fire sale to J.P. Morgan means in the bigger picture. Guys like legendary Wall Street investor Jim Rogers said the markets are best left to equalize on their own.
And I really don't like saving a bunch of guys on Wall Street so they can keep their Maseratis.
But University of Maryland economics professor Peter Morici was among those who argued that if Uncle Sam hadn't intervened, disaster would have struck.
Think of it like a city. If the water company has bad business practices, we might not have much sympathy for the stockholders and the management. But if the water company goes down, the city dies.
Just how far-reaching the collapse of a venerable Wall Street institution will prove for the rest of the economy and the rest of us seems to require a crystal ball, which Bob Frick of Kiplinger's confessed he didn't have.
What's going to happen? Man, I don't know.
Nobody does. But Frick said these sobering times are a good moment for we, the people, to assess what we've got in our own personal piggy banks.
It's kind of like global warming. If you only think there's a 20% chance that global warming's happening, you still have to take precautions.
More than ever, taking the long view seems to be the best strategy.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here now for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And Chris, everybody out there is emailing us to say, what do we do? Where do we put our money safely right now?
Well, and with good reason, Lisa. I mean, look at the story you just did. I mean, we're all unnerved by what's going on in the markets right now.
I know. You know, my dad even wrote to me the other day and it was asking me, he never asks me personal questions, but he asked me to make sure that my money was safe. So I'm very happy that I'm talking to you now on behalf of all our listeners. We've been looking on this show at other options for our money than the obvious, things like buying gold. Then you hear banks are in trouble. Is anything safe besides my piggy bank these days?
Well, your piggy bank is safe. And there's no reason for people to panic, because here's the straight story. It's easy to keep your money safe. The bad news is you better be ready for low returns.
Yeah, well, I've already been noticing that in my bank account every month as I look at the rates adjusting. It's very sobering.
It's very paltry. What, 1%, 1.5%?
But the fact remains that that probably is right now, besides the piggy bank, the safest place to park your cash if you've got any. And that's in just a regular savings account.
That's right. You want to put your money, your really safe money, if you're concerned, is in a bank with Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation backing, you know, the FDIC. And then the other really safe place to park your money is in the U.S. Treasury market, particularly T-bills. You're not going to get much of a yield on that money, but it is safe.
Can you explain, Chris, for us why the rates on savings are plummeting, why we're watching them go down?
There are really several reasons. One, the Federal Reserve has been cutting its benchmark interest rate. Second, and probably even more important, flight to quality. You really see that in the Treasury market, where these are default-free securities, T-bills. Money is pouring into it for safety, very little yield.
Money market mutual funds. I know for years I've heard that these were good, safe, one step above the plain vanilla savings account kinds of things. What about now, though? Is that still true with all the turmoil?
You know, basically because money market mutual funds invest in very short-term securities, they are very safe. And of course, the goal is we don't want to break a buck. That's the jargon term. In other words, the dollar you put in should be worth a dollar when you pull it out. And my second safety net is you want to be with a, you know, money market mutual fund that's backed by a major brand name institution that has a reputation at work. Because if there is some trouble, you want to have an institution with a brand name that it has to protect so that it may shore up that fund if that becomes necessary.
But what happens if that major brand name goes bust?
Okay, for example, like with Bear Stearns?
Yeah.
You're basically safe. First of all, the main layer of protection is you're a valuable customer. Look what has happened. J.P. Morgan is taking over those accounts. And that's what's going to happen most of the time. Then we have SIPC, the Securities Investor Protection Corporation, which provides protection up to $500,000. And then most of your major brokerage houses and financial institutions buy additional layers of insurance above and beyond the $500,000 that comes with SIPC.
So the name of the game here, Chris, is safety.
That's right. Say it again and again.
Thank you, Chris Farrell, our economics editor.
Thanks a lot, Lisa.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Lost in the headlines of the subprime mess is the story of commercial real estate. It's not suffering quite the way residential real estate has, not yet. But PricewaterhouseCoopers just surveyed the commercial landscape, and the title it gave the report speaks volumes. It's called Rough Road Ahead for Investors. You'd have to have a pretty strong stomach to plunk any money into the commercial real estate world right now. Susan Smith is editor-in-chief of the report. Susan, what rough patches are you seeing?
For the past 10 years, I think investors on the commercial side were really, you know, loving every moment of what was going on. Rents were rising and the deal flow was great. And it seemed like everything was moving along really fine. And now all of a sudden, buyers and sellers aren't seeing eye to eye on pricing. And we're also seeing in some sectors, possibly an increase of new space, space that developers started to build when the economy was doing really well and market conditions were great. And unfortunately, those projects now are getting ready to be delivered at a time when demand is slowing down.
Is there a connection between the residential downturn and the commercial downturn? Are there similarities?
You know, the one thing I think, you know, you really have to keep in mind is that the residential market and the commercial property market, they're really two very different markets. And at the beginning of last year, when we started with the subprime mortgage problems in the residential side, you were really seeing a lot of problems because of an oversupply of space. And, you know, we were fortunate enough in the commercial side to not have that. Unfortunately, what happened was all of the subprime problems and the mortgages and the lending, you know, it really put a red flag throughout the whole entire financial industry. And it made lending more difficult, not only on the residential side, but also in the commercial side.
But it does seem like both markets are linked to what happens to me as an individual, even if I have no money in the game, no skin in the game, so to speak, right?
No, absolutely. I mean, they are linked. And, you know, when something happens in the overall economy, it's felt probably first with the consumer, and then it trickles its way out into, you know, every aspect. But again, it's just really important also to realize that as a commercial side is definitely healthier than what's going on in the residential side.
And that's the upshot of this report, even though you've titled it Rough Road Ahead for Investors?
I believe so, because you know, there's more difficulty in going out and finding that property that you want to buy, or even listing a property and trying to sell it. So in terms of what buyers and sellers were used to over the past 10 years and what they're encountering now, it's definitely going to be a rough road. But it's also important to realize that there are opportunities out there for investors. It's just a matter of what your strategy is. And I always like to think that real estate investors are optimistic.
You also have to have a very strong stomach, too, I would imagine.
I think you do. I think you do. You know, people always say to me, well, you're in real estate. I can't believe you don't own so much real estate. And I say, well, you know, I know what goes into it. I know how people react to all the things you have to watch in real estate, what's going on with employment and what's going on with the consumer. And, you know, there's just too much to focus on that. It does. You need a strong stomach and good optimism.
Thank you so much, Susan, for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Susan Smith is with PricewaterhouseCoopers. Pulling out of an HSA account could be bad for your financial health. Chris tells you why in our Getting Personal segment. And a tourist remembers the good old days of traveling to India.
Oh, they wanted our dollars. Now, no, they don't want.
India declines the dollar. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Lisa Napoli in for Tess Vigeland. Last Monday, the dollar hit an all-time low against the euro, $1.59. It bounced back a bit, but even so, the dollar has been dropping so fast, some European exchanges won't accept American currency. Of course, travelers to Europe have long been aware their money isn't buying as much as before. But how about travelers to India? Our own Rico Galliano went there recently, and he found even in developing nations, the dollar just ain't what it used to be.
The Indian city of Agra is a maze of snaky roads clogged with traffic. Except in one place, the Taj Mahal. Cars are banned in a half-kilometer radius to keep pollution from staining the white marble. Not that a walk to the front gates is peaceful. The road is lined with ragtag shops selling light-up Tajes, glow-in-the-dark Tajes, Tajes in snow globes, and anything else a tourist might need.
Yes, sir. You need some memory card batteries?
The prices here are exclusively in rupees, except one place, the box office of the Taj itself.
Hello. How much is it to enter?
One ticket, 750.
750 rupees?
Yeah.
How many dollars?
$5 plus 500 Indian rupees.
$5 plus?
$5 plus 500 Indian rupees.
Pretty neat. I paid in all rupees. I didn't have greenbacks handy. But this frequent tourist to India did.
My name is Inez, and I'm from California.
And what did you pay to get into the Taj today?
Taj was about 500 rupees and 5 American dollars, and they did take American dollars.
The Taj does this because around 5 years ago, when the Archaeological Survey of India set admission rates, the dollar was relatively strong. A.K. Sinha is a superintendent at the survey.
We were taking the value of dollar as 50 rupees.
But as of this recording, it's more like 40. In just the last 15 months, the dollar's lost around 10% against the rupee. So if you pay with dollars at the Taj, you're getting a bargain. That's why soon, you won't have the option.
Maybe within a month, the entrance fee, which is accepted in form of dollars, that would be discontinued, and we would be charging only in the Indian currency.
That'll go for more than 100 other Indian monuments for which the survey charges admission. Inez from California says it's just the latest example of how things have changed for Americans in India.
In the past, people used to be really happy if we had dollars. Oh, they wanted our dollars. Now, no, they don't want.
That's sad.
And it can be even sadder if you're an Indian doing business with Americans. Americans like, say, me. While in India, I employed Prachi Bhatti. She's what we jet-setting international reporters call a fixer. She worked as my translator and...
I also help set up interviews for foreign journalists while they are here in India, which I have done for you, Rico.
And she was great. But she required cash payment, preferably in rupees, at the end of each day. Now, normally you pay a fixer with a check in dollars a week or so after you get home.
But ever since 2007, we have found that we end up losing a little bit of money, rather a lot of money, by the time the check gets deposited in our bank. The last time I did this through a check transaction, I ended up losing around $40 because of the decline of the dollar.
Not a budget-busting amount for most of us, but Prachi says $40 is 30% of many Indians' monthly income. Bottom line, she'd rather get paid quickly in a currency that's not in freefall. Now, should the greenback experience an upswing, the Archaeological Survey's A.K. Sinha says dollars could again be welcome at the Taj Mahal. Of course, not that many people actually pay in dollars.
The figure is quite negligible, 10%. 10% people pay in dollars. So, I mean, it hardly matters, in fact.
It's more of a symbol of the times, I think.
Exactly, exactly. I do agree with you.
In Agra, India, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement and by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more online at saveandinvest.org.
Call me sentimental, but for some reason, I like to keep my old ID cards. I have my college ID. That's from a long time ago. And ID cards from at least a couple of old jobs. Some universities are trying to make the ID card more than just a way to check out books at the library by having them serve double duty as debit cards. And that's raising a host of questions. Kathy Chu wrote about the controversy for USA Today. Kathy, how did these things work?
It's usually a contract between the university and a financial institution. And the university gets money based on a few different factors. One is the number of bank accounts that are open that are linked to the ID card. Second, some universities will also get money based on how much students spend.
Are you obligated to use it? Is there any way around this, or do you have to use it if you're a student at one of these schools?
You don't have to use it, Lisa, but the problem is at some schools, including Portland State University, the students said it's been very difficult for them to opt out of it. For example, if all of the students would get an ID card with a MasterCard logo, and they could sign up and link their bank accounts with this partner institution to the ID cards. They could also opt out of the bank account, meaning it would not be linked to their ID card. But when students went online to try and opt out of the bank account, too many of them found themselves accidentally signing up for the cards. And this is the case at other universities as well. So to their credit, Portland University and the bank that it partnered with changed the activation process so it wasn't as difficult to opt out of the bank account.
And it's not just that students are upset that they're locked into this. They're upset about the fees.
They're upset about a few things, Lisa. Overdraft fees is one. Now, over the years, banks have increasingly allowed you to overdraw on not only checks, but on small dollar amount debit card transactions. So in the past, if you tried to use your debit card for something you didn't have money for, the bank would reject the transaction, no fee involved. Nowadays, they'll approve the transaction even if it's for a $2 cup of coffee, and they will charge you a $30 fee for it.
And they're not told about these overdraft fees to begin with? Or is it in the fine, tiny print kind of thing?
They're given disclosures, sure. So you can argue that they are told about the overdraft fees. But students' argument and consumer advocates' argument is, listen, we don't have a lot of financial experience. If a university is going to be partnering with a bank, why allow the students to overdraw and then charge them a stiff fee for doing so?
Sounds like some people are learning this lesson the hard way. Do you have any tips or advice for people who are heading off to college about how to buyer beware with these things?
The first thing you want to do is if your university has a partnership with a bank related to debit cards or to credit cards, never assume this is the best account or product for you. If you're going to get the debit card offered by the university, ask what concessions you can get. And what I mean by that is ask the university, ask the bank, if they will waive certain fees, such as overdraft fees. Very often they will do so if you ask. And obviously, balance your bank account and don't spend more than you don't have. Try to be financially responsible.
Kathy Chu is a personal finance reporter for USA Today. Thank you, Kathy.
Thank you, Lisa.
It is time once again for Getting Personal. This is where we answer your money questions every week. I'm Lisa Napoli. I'm sitting in for Tess Vigland. And with me is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Our first caller today is Jean, and she's from Indianapolis. She's a yoga teacher there. Hi, Jean.
Hi, Lisa.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm very well, and I'm very happy that you're going to talk to us this morning. Thank you.
Me too. Thanks for calling or taking my call.
Excellent. So Chris and I are here right now, and we're ready to get started, if you are, which I presume you are.
Well, I'm doing my best to be. I have to follow my 10-month-old around a little bit,
uh-oh,
but if I get out of breath, you'll know why.
It'll make it more interesting for us if you have to chase a child during the taping, because that doesn't always happen. So.
He was supposed to be napping, but he...
Now, why a 10-month-old cannot follow instructions, I don't understand.
You know, I'm just absolutely bewildered.
Great. Well, so before we get too ahead of ourselves, why don't we talk, Jean? I guess you're looking at moving the family to San Francisco, and you have what sounds like maybe a tricky situation with your house.
Yes, we have kind of an interesting mortgage deal. Our house as it is right now could fetch around $300,000. The thing that gets tricky is that over time, my father-in-law gifted us funds for the sole purpose of paying off the mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
But now we pay him every month. That way he wanted to hopefully avoid some of the tax issues of inheritance tax later on.
Mm. Wow. So Chris, what do you make of this kind of complicated situation? If they sell their house and move, how would they pay back the father-in-law?
Well, there's a couple things. First of all, he gifted you the money, so it's your money. It's not a loan. It can't be a loan. It's gifted. Part of the whole thing with gifting money is that the father or the whomever is doing the gifting, you know, they give up all control and right to the money. So it's yours. So when you sell the home, you don't have any obligation with that. In fact, it's not a loan. It's a gift. So it's your money.
But the issue is that you've taken the money that was given to you as a gift, paid off the loan, and it's not really a gift, it doesn't sound like, you're paying
back.
It's
more of a loan. He is charging us interest, but came to us in the form of a gift, so we wouldn't have to pay taxes.
Chris, what do you make of it? How would you deal with it?
Well, we got a little bit of a confused situation here because we got gifts, but we also are treating it as a loan. I was glad when you mentioned that he's charging interest, because one of the things family members always need to be aware of, and this is not just for you, but just to make a general statement, is that you want to charge essentially something around the market rate interest, because that way you stay on the good side of the Internal Revenue Service, the IRS. And it's just an important thing to do. And then when you would sell the home, you would simply pay off the loan to your father. And there's no tax consequence to him because he's essentially just getting his loan back. You know, that's what I would do.
Okay.
Great. Thank you, Gene.
Thank you so much.
Good luck to you. That's a big decision.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Are you tangled in a money web? We can help set you free. Just visit our website, marketplace.org, and click on the Getting Personal link. Or you can give us a call at 1-877-275-6669. That's 1-877-ASK-MONEY without an E. All right, Chris, so now we're going to look at our email. We've got one from Amber in San Francisco. She opened a health savings account, HSA, last year, but she's not happy with the account. She's saying to us that her healthcare provider barely knows how to administer the plan, and so she says she's getting terrible customer service. And unfortunately, due to some unexpected health costs that have come along this year, she hasn't been able to save much money. Amber wants to know how badly she's going to be penalized on her 2008 taxes if she closes the HSA. And is there a way to get out of the HSA and minimize her losses? This is something many of us are facing right now, as our employers are asking us to consider these things. Right, Chris?
That's right. There's a couple of things. First of all, she hasn't put much money in there. So the money she withdraws, she'll pay whatever her ordinary income tax rate is on that money, plus a 10% penalty. So that's the hit. And it's actually the 10% penalty that really causes the extra hit there. But there's another thing you can do. If she can, just leave it alone. Let it grow. You can use it for qualified medical expenses. You just can't add to it. But why not just leave it alone if it's not that much money and you don't need it? And we all face medical bills at some point. They always come up. And just use it for those purposes.
But Chris, just a brief primer on the HSA, which is a very complicated thing, admittedly, for people who may not be aware of them. This is the kind,
right.
This is the thing where you take out money every check and sort of sock it away in the event that you need it. And if you don't use it, it goes away, right?
Well, what it is, it's really two things. One, you have to have, by definition, what's called a high deductible health insurance plan, right? So it's attached to a high deductible health insurance plan. And then there's this very special savings account. And that savings account you use to pay for what we call qualified medical expenses. And as long as you're using that money for qualified medical expenses, it's tax-free dollars. And now, unlike some employees will be aware of flexible spending accounts they might have at work, and that's the old use it or lose it. You don't use it by the end of the year, you lose it. Health savings account, you don't use it, it compounds, continues to grow. So it can be there 5 years from now if you're and you may need it then.
Okay. Are you sick of your health plan? We may have a cure to your problem. Our phone number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY without an E. We're answering your questions every weekday online at marketplace.org, too. Just click on the Getting Personal link. Stay tuned for more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It's tough to do a show about personal finance. You have to paint everything in shades of gray, because very little in the financial world is certain. How nice would it be if everything were black and white for a while? An extreme example, pro wrestling. You got good guys, you got bad guys, they fight. Simple, right? Well, not if you're one of the guys doing the fighting. On this week's Day in the Work Life, we get in the ring with a pro wrestler.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear. The fact remains that I am an Olympic gold medalist, TNA World Heavyweight Champion, and I am better than you.
My name is Kurt Angle, TNA World Heavyweight Champion, and Olympic gold medalist, and 12-time world champion, but who's counting? As an amateur wrestler, my brothers were all very good. I wasn't. I actually, my first year, I was 1-16, lost 16 matches. Actually, I was 2-16. One of the matches I won by forfeit. The child didn't show up. But every year, I got better. And what do you know? You know, in the long run, I'm the one that won the state title. I'm the one that won the national titles. I won 6 national titles. When I won the Olympic gold medal, that's all I strive for my whole life. So the next morning I woke up and thought, what am I going to do now? You know, I was lost. And I tried sportscasting. I did that for a year. I didn't like it. Finally, I started watching wrestling, pro wrestling. And I thought, I'm not quite done being an athlete yet. Being an amateur wrestler, you're taught to show no emotion, go for the pinfall as quickly as you can and get it done. In pro wrestling, you're taught to show emotion, include the crowd to the match, tell a story in that match, and that was the hardest thing for me to learn, was the psychology of professional wrestling. You got to go out there and have the right psychology to get the fans behind the match, whether you're a good guy or you're a heel, a bad guy. And I was able to pick that up within the first year. Hard day for me usually starts out at 5 in the morning and flying to the UK, 14 hours, probably doing about 3 hours of media tour, going straight to the gym, workout, get my workout in, watching every single match so I can watch what every single wrestler's doing, because I'm not just a talent, I'm a teacher as well. Do my match and then know that we're probably going to have to drive 4 hours to do the next show the next morning. When you have tours like that that last 9 or 10 days, you start to get pretty run down. They pay me very well. How about this? I've made up to $3 million in a year, and right now, money's not that important to me, but I still make about 7 figures. I am never in character when I'm outside in the streets. I am always very polite. The fans get it. They know that the person on TV isn't particularly the person that you're going to see on the streets. But a lot of big guys that are very dominant in wrestling, they weigh 270 pounds and they're 6'3", and you know, they look like monsters, and they start buying into their character and believing that they are monsters when really it takes me 10 seconds to take them out. Those are the kind of guys I feel bad for. If you really believe in your character, then there's something really wrong.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Julie Miller. Chris Farrell returns to answer more of your questions in Getting Personal up next. And paying taxes is tough enough without getting scammed.
The IRS does not contact people by email.
That and other tips to avoid tax time ripoffs. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Lisa Napoli in for Tess Vigeland. You can't build a skyscraper without a blueprint. Same goes with building a nest egg. Since you're listening to this show, you probably know you're supposed to plan for the future. But when you finally decide that now is the time to do it, how exactly are you supposed to start? And what's the safest way? Reporter Sally Herships went to find out for herself.
I just turned 35 and left my job of 7 years. Seems like a good time to talk to a financial planner. They're the ones who can help my money make money, right? But do I keep saving so I have enough to hire one now? Or do I take what I've got and see if a planner can work some magic? And what do financial planners do anyway? I went to talk to Karen Schaefer, chair of the Certified Financial Planning Board of Standards, to find out.
We're not just going to look at the investments. We're not just going to look at the taxes or the insurance. But we're going to look at their entire financial picture and help them achieve their goals.
Turns out I was all mixed up. And it's not just me.
What people are very confused about, and understandably so, is the difference between financial planning and investment planning.
I'm really embarrassed I didn't get this. It's investment advisors who help pump up your bank account. Planners help you, yeah, you guessed it, plan. They help you find the money to invest with in the first place.
You know, if I just stopped with the credit card debt, or if I go become a one-car family for the next year or so instead of a two-car family, I mean, there are lots of things that we can do that can help us find those dollars. If I waited till I had the dollars, I might be waiting too long, maybe forever.
There's no time like the present, so I went to see financial planner Kathy Boyle in New York.
Hi.
Hi. Are you Kathy?
Boyle started off asking the big picture questions.
How much is your health care costing you? What's your real budget? What's your goal? What's your income earning potential over the next 5 years?
But I went to her with a more specific goal, a down payment for a 3-bedroom Brooklyn condo.
So based on your income and your current ability to save and your expenses, you're really looking at probably an 8 to 9 year plan, unless Mr. Wonderful comes into your life and has an income with you.
Wait a minute. 8 or 9 years? Did you say 8 or 9?
I was totally shocked. I asked Boyle what would help.
You need to make more money.
Can I buy a car?
Yes, you can buy a car, but that's a depreciating asset. So that's not going to get you closer to your goal.
Okay, so no house for about a decade. It was a real eye-opener. It forced me to face cold, hard facts. But there's still hope.
You can buy a house or you can buy an apartment. You just have to change your parameters a bit. It's not going to be in the chicer areas of Brooklyn. You may have to go out into an area that's turning, you know, or that had further away from the city. Now, if you were open to living in suburbia or New Jersey, it becomes a different kettle of fish.
I really feel like now I should have started saving 10 years ago.
Should have, could have, would have is the favorite phrase in our life. And the best time to have started saving was 10 years ago. The next best time is right now.
So back to my original question. When does it make sense to get professional financial advice? How much do you need in the bank to make it worth the fees?
It's hard to say $5,000, $10,000, $50,000, but I would say if you're serious about saving money and you have $10,000 saved and you can add to that, it's worth spending $400 or $500 a year.
That, says Boyle, works out to about 4 or 5%. What you'd pay in fees if you bought a fund.
Yes, and remember, part of the rule of investing is the same as real estate. Diversify, diversify, diversify. So you have to have enough money to put it into 4 or 5 or 6 categories.
Find a planner or an advisor who will bill you hourly. That's Boyle's personal advice. You also, she says, have to make specific goals, which she suggests laminating and hanging somewhere you'll see it every day.
Do you have goals in your shower?
I do. That gets you very, very focused. You wake up every morning and you say, okay, what am I going to do today to get closer to that goal?
For now, I'm going to hold off on finding a financial advisor. So what's next? Starting to save aggressively. It's number one on my list of goals, hanging in the shower. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
We are back again with Getting Personal. I'm Lisa Napoli in for Tess Viglund this week. With me is our personal finance expert, Chris Farrell. Chris, right now we've got an email from Bridget in Cincinnati, Ohio. Bridget is a college senior. She says she doesn't have a lot of money, but she wants to invest in a microfinance fund. Bridget has never invested before, and she wants to know what the minimum amount is that she can invest.
Well, most of your microfinance funds, and just for a definition, these are tiny, tiny loans that are largely made in the developing world, mostly to women, and it's to encourage sustainability, self-sufficiency, and it's having a remarkable impact in large parts of the developing world. Most microfinance, it's for very wealthy individuals and foundations, but there are some that are open to individuals. Now, the minimums that I've seen are typically around $1,000. And you can get information about them at two places that are very good. One is the Microfinance Information Exchange, and it's otherwise known as MIX. And then there's also a wonderful socially responsible industry trade group website, socialinvest.org. And if you go to their community investing section, they have a lot of information for individuals, more people like you and me and Bridget, who want to be investing in microfinance, what are going to be their options.
I was under the impression that I could go onto a website and find a particular situation that I might want to support rather than in a more general sense, just throwing money at a particular nonprofit group.
Right. What you're essentially doing is putting money into a fund, which is then distributed down to the grassroots. But here's my cautionary note. First of all, you may get nothing back, maybe 2 to 3% on your money. The other thing, if you are senior in college, you don't have much money, you want to start building your portfolio, I think it's wonderful that you want to support microfinance, and that's fine. But you may also want to think about some other alternatives, socially responsible mutual funds, where you can invest small amounts of money and perhaps earn a higher return.
It sounds to me as if Bridget is trying to merge the notion of charitable giving with investing, in which case the socially responsible mutual fund would be probably a more prudent way to go. I wasn't aware of these microfinance funds. I was aware of the microfinancing, but the idea of my investing in your business and expecting that it's going to, or in someone's business and expecting that it's going to yield me money down the road doesn't seem like you're saying, the very best financial bet.
Right. And there are funds out there and they are reaching out to the individuals just like people like her. And I say you might get a somewhere between 0 to 3% return. And I can't criticize her and I'm not criticizing her. I think it's a wonderful thing to do. But at that stage of life, I'd be thinking about some alternatives to investigate.
Okay. If you need a lesson on investing, look no further. Visit our website, marketplace.org, and click on the Getting Personal link. Or you can give us a call with your questions. 1-877-275-6669 is the number. That's 1-877-ASK-MONEY. All right, Chris, let's go back to the phones. Right now, we've got Shaw from Minneapolis on the line. How are you today, Shaw?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Good. Thanks for writing in. Shaw, you're 42 years old. You've got a balance of $190,000 left on your mortgage. What is your question for Chris today?
My question is, my financial advisor has advised that I should pay off my $190,000 mortgage, and he also suggested that the $30,000 on the car should also be eliminated, as well as the credit cards. I understand the car and the credit card debt does need to be cleared, but I didn't quite understand why I should necessarily, you know, eliminate the $190,000.
Right. That would be my question, too. At your age, it seems imprudent if you've still got an income to pay off the mortgage. Is that true, Chris?
Well, there's no right or wrong answer, but I'll lay out my thinking for you. First of all, you're absolutely right. Your financial advisor is absolutely right. We get rid of the credit card debt. We get rid of the car loans. The way that I look at the mortgage situation is that most of our wealth is tied to our homes. And so the reason why I don't like people to pay off their mortgage is that it's better to build up your other financial assets, to diversify more and more into stocks, into bonds, into commercial real estate, into savings, you know, whatever you're putting your money in, and so that your home shrinks as a portion of your overall wealth. At that point, once it's a smaller part of your overall wealth and you're well diversified, then it makes a lot of sense to pay off your mortgage if you can. Why not? You might as well get rid of the debt, and then you're living debt-free, and that's a wonderful state to be in. But a lot of times, people want to pay off that mortgage, but they have very small retirement plans. They have very small savings, and they'd love to say goodbye to the bank for the last time. And what I'd like them to do is build up that well-diversified portfolio, and then if you want to pay off the mortgage, go right ahead. What's the interest rate on your mortgage?
It's 6.5.
Okay, so you have a 6.5% mortgage. One way of thinking about that is if you paid off the mortgage, you made 6.5% on your money. Do you believe over a period of time, by investing, could you do better than 6.5%? you know, right now, hardly anyone's going to do better than 6.5%. But over a period of time, you believe, you know, by investing, building this diversified portfolio, you're not going to do a little, you know, 6.5% or a little bit better, then that's how you should be investing your money. If you're not going to do better than 6.5%, or you don't believe you'll do better than 6.5%, that is a reason that would lean you toward paying off the mortgage, because at least you'll get that return on your money. I think from our discussion and from what you've said, the desire to build a diversified portfolio and that you're a good saver, my guess is that, you know, you're going to do okay going forward. And again, the answer leads you toward not paying off your mortgage right away.
I agree.
That was very simple. Thank you for being so easy for us, Shaw.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
All right. That's all the questions we can take on this week's show. But Chris is now going to answer your personal finance questions online every weekday. Just visit our website, marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link. You can also call us at 1-877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, thanks for everything this week.
Thanks a lot.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Finally, today, there's never been a better reason to get your tax returns off in time. Those hotly debated stimulus checks won't get to you if you don't fill out a tax return. And if you haven't filed yours yet, a word of caution. Be prepared to avoid some pretty shady characters looking to fleece you out of your hard-earned money. Internet scammers. Every year, the IRS releases a list of the dirty dozen tax scams. And to help us sort it through, we asked IRS spokesman Victor Omelchenko to help us out. Victor, the first thing on the list is internet phishing. Tell us how this works.
When you hear the word phishing, you think, oh, you're out on the lake or you're out on the ocean trying to catch something to eat or put into your aquarium. But phishing is internet-based identity thieves. They go around, particularly during tax filing season, to fish for information, to fish for your personal financial information by tricking you into revealing, for instance, your Social Security number or your bank account number with the promise you will get your tax refund quicker.
So what might this email look like that I get from a bad guy?
It will look like it's coming from the IRS, but it's not coming from the IRS because the IRS does not contact people by email.
So this is a more sophisticated ruse than someone calling me up and pretending to be from the IRS. They're just using the computer. This was a big thing with bank accounts.
Lisa, and that's just a scam.
Right. So this is the first year that phishing has been the number one problem. What's the number two problem? Because that seems like a very new to this year kind of issue.
It's the scam that's related to what many people here have been hearing about, the stimulus, the economic stimulus payment, otherwise commonly referred to as the tax rebate. Mm-hmm. What the IRS has discovered is that these crooks, besides maybe sending emails, they've now started posing as IRS representatives, and they're using the phone to call people and to say, hi, this is the IRS, and we want you to give your Social Security number or your bank account, and we will get your special stimulus payment into your checking account faster. But what the IRS wants people to know is that we do not make phone calls to you talking about, hey, give us information and we'll give you your tax rebate quicker. We don't do that. People have to file a 2007 tax year return, and then the IRS will look at it and calculate the stimulus payment if you're eligible for it.
But nobody's going to be calling me and saying, hey, what's the
Nobody's going to be calling you from the IRS. Do not believe any of these calls.
Now, number three, on the face of it, I don't understand. Frivolous arguments. What does that mean?
Arguments that people use saying, based on my reading of the Constitution, I don't have to pay taxes. They read into the law things that aren't there. That time and time again, the U.S. tax court has said, no, taxes are something that you have to pay if you have taxable income.
So this is a scam against the government, not a scam that I, as a consumer, have to look out for.
It's a scam against the government, but you want to be sure when you select a tax preparer. And listen, almost all tax preparers, the IRS couldn't do its job if we didn't have the professional tax preparation community.
Right.
But as in any profession, there's some bad oranges in the bunch. And there's sometimes some tax preparers, people who have seminars or workshops, and they're telling you, oh, you can do this, you can do that. You don't have to pay your taxes. I'll get your taxes lower if you do
gotcha.
This or that. And so they're really trying to trick you into getting something that you shouldn't be getting. If it sounds too good to be true, it is.
It is, yeah. Victor, there are 12 things here. We can't go through every single one of them, but there's a wealth of information on your website, right?
That's right. www.irs.gov. You can get all the information you want there about the Dirty Dozen tax scams, as well as about the economic stimulus payment.
Victor Omelchenko is the spokesman for the IRS here in Los Angeles. Thank you, Victor.
Oh, thank you, Lisa.
That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, we're taking a closer look at some tough housing issues.
You know, maybe you will have to sell your house, but better to sell it than to wait and continue throwing good money after bad.
Marketplace Money is produced by John Haas with Rico Galliano, Janae Darden, Stephen Hoffman, James Richter, Michelle Philippi, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Lisa Napoli in for Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.